different perspective. We have been getting a lot of interesting news from North Africa and from the Middle East, and not that good news from Wisconsin as far as early this morning. But this is also something that has been happening lately, which is also a very big story that we can use for contextualize a little bit what we are going to try to do today with our guest speakers. This lawsuit, this famous lawsuit that started in 1993, I think to remember, has gotten into a new phase. A judge in Ecuador has ordered Chevron to pay all this money, almost $17 billion, to a group of people in northern Ecuador, in the Amazonia in northern Ecuador, about a group of 30,000 people organized around something they call Frente de Defensa de la Amazonia, because of some pollution that initially Texaco and then Chevron had been carrying in the region since the 1970s. Just to give you an idea, this is the second largest total assess for environmental damages. It's just $3 billion behind what is the fund for BP's Gulf Coast oil spill. So we are talking definitely some big money, and therefore, as we can expect, Chevron, of course, is going to appeal, but it's also hinting that they may not pay, of course, not that money, nor any money at all. After all, they are leaving Ecuador, so there is nothing that the government take from Chevron in order to enforce this payment. Let me see, this is a little bit slow. The plaintiffs, of course, are going to appeal the decision as well and ask for some more money. The lawsuit initially was filed in 1993 in New York on behalf of these 30,000 Amazonian residents. Nevertheless, after about close to 10 years, Texaco Chevron won the legal motion in 2002, and they relocated the case back to Ecuador, where they thought that they were going to have a better chance of winning the lawsuit even than in the United States. It was the trial was started in New York City. Also part of the background, of course, is what they actually have been doing over there since 1972. Texaco started the exploitation in the Ecuadorian Amazon. They built the Transandean pipeline. They also opened 300 oil wells, about 900 open waste pits, which we are going to come back to that, processing facilities, pumping stations, oil refinery. Besides the impact of the industry itself, the other big impact related to the oil industry was the network of roads that they opened and that allow for homesteading for about 200,000 poor Spanish-speaking farmers and colonos who almost invaded the zone and take land out of indigenous people also at that time. The main concern has been the open waste pits, wastes that surface during the drilling process, sludge, water, and usually heavy crude, untreated chemical, muds, industrial solvents essential for drilling, all this trash that the Texaco and Chevron never really took good care of according to the standards of the industry in order to cut costs and make a better profits. And these pits have been contaminating the environment in northern Ecuador, the overflow of water and soil systems, and therefore the quality of life of these people. This story has been told in different narratives, and the story itself has its own narrative. One very interesting at the beginning of this struggle, way back in the 1990s, was that the community themselves were performing indigenous identities here in New York. I remember it was January or February when the trial started in New York City, and some indigenous peoples, although I'm not sure if they were truly indigenous or they were performing to be indigenous people in front of the courthouse in Manhattan, wearing their traditional costume as if they were in the rainforest in the middle of the winter. And that was a strategy common at that time in the 1990s in Latin America. One of the narratives, of course, is the narrative of the impact of this pollution on biodiversity. Although if you follow these stories, it's never clear exactly what is being damaged. You don't find a clear inventory of particularly what species are being affected by this pollution. We all assume that because the pollution is happening, of course, it's going to have an impact. But this is part of the narrative that seems to work when it is more vague than specific. And among all these narratives, one narrative in particular that has had a big impact on this is this documentary, Crude, by Joe Berlinger, that gathers the 10 or more years, almost 20 years of the struggle. They have been taping all this struggle for almost 20 years and never released anything before, and just decided to do it in 2009 when the struggle got to a stalemate. Within this movie, there are several narratives that are familiar to us in environmental movements. Probably the one that we'll be able to recognize better is the narrative of the decline of environment and the narrative of loss that in the seminar we have visited with the help of Ursula during the past week, as expressed by this Kofan Indian. Immediately, this is something that she said actually a few weeks ago when the judge ruled in favor of the Frente de Defensa de la Amazonía. "Most of our women no longer sing, but today I will sing for you. We live upon the river of rich, clean waters. With the arrival of the company and their contamination, my brothers are now dead. I am the only survivor of my family. My message of my song is to tell the world so that the world can know what has been done. I worry about the future. What will happen to the children? What will become of my people?" Other narratives, of course, are part of this documentary, are part of these struggles. This is the narrative in these very important alliances have taken place between indigenous and non-indigenous people, even performing the indigenous identity, between the plaintiffs in the Amazon with NGOs or organizations in alliances that went through borders with Amazon Watch, Rainforest Alliance, Amnesty International, and so on. There is a large number of organizations involved of this. These narratives have taken place in different media. They have taken place on Ecuadorian TV. At a certain point, President Correa visited the contaminated area, and for the first time, this was on national TV, on national Ecuadorian TV. There was an expose story in Vanity Fair, focused on one of the lawyers involved, a very young lawyer involved with the struggle, who received this prize in 2008, the CNN Prize of Heroes Honor. So it's a narrative that has been happening inside and outside Ecuador and in different media. And often also is a narrative, it's an epic narrative. The humbly heroic Ecuadorian lawyer, Pablo Fajardo, in a way the story of the struggle of these people in the documentary is a little bit the struggle of his coming to age as a man and as a leader of his community. The steady leader of the Kofan, the indigenous steady leader of the Kofan, the colono mother, Maria Garofalo, determined to treat her 18-year-old daughter cancer. There is a legal advisor that has been helping in getting organized and making connections with the transnational forces. Like in many other occasions in the past, Sting was involved here. More than Sting on this occasion, his wife, Trudy Styler, were part of the campaign too. And of course, on the other hand, there is the corporation, its lawyers, the lawyers in the United States, the lawyers in Ecuador, in an epic that, to tell you the truth, has a lot of overtones of The Lord of the Rings. The same kind of characters, the same kind of mission, the same kind of burden. Why is that I'm bringing up this case? Because this case challenged us in ways that our speakers today, they raise some questions that our speakers today have been considering also in their own work, focused on a different corpus. Of course, they are not devoted to the Ecuadorian Amazon, but one of the questions that we are addressing nowadays in the field of ecocriticism, I cannot handle this. Okay, we'll play it slow then. First is the question of what is environmentalism beyond Western or global mainstream environmentalism? How do we identify and understand the scope in space and time of what an environmental problem or what an environmental conflict is? How do we figure out then our responses to these environmental problems? How do these environmentalisms dial, negotiate, or clash with global mainstream environmentalisms? What are the narratives of these environmentalisms? When and why certain narratives are successful? What do these narratives lack? When and why such a narrative needs to be criticized? And overall, how do they help us advance not only in terms of environmental politics, but in terms of ecological thinking? And Rob Nixon, Kate Sandilands, Tim Morton, and Ursula Heise's work in recent years do raise similar questions regarding other corpuses, other corpora. So if you're not particularly interested in those areas, you can see, it has been in my case, that from their work, we can draw some implications and some questions that we can transfer into our own areas. So that may be useful for further, if you want to pursue this kind of interest in your own work and in your own field. So without further delay, I'll let Von Anderson, who is going to moderate our first session, introduce Rob and get us all started. Thank you very much.